The Cinema Specialists are back, and here we are with our third iteration of our year in review. It's the 2023 year in review, and for anybody who's new to this, we don't just talk about 2023 films. We bounce all over the place, and we'll be talking about a whole bunch of movies that came out or that we watched throughout this year. That's what we try to do. We try to break it down so that we get a little bit of everything in, especially since this is the first year we're actually doing a podcast that we've been talking about new movies. So by talking about new movies, we have given our opinions a lot on these other films from 2023 throughout the year. So that might be a little bit less shocking this year. So we mixed it up a little bit and we're here. We're here for like the next hour, 15 minutes to break down what our best of 2023 and worst of, unfortunately, in some cases, are.
Yeah. Yeah, it's exciting. You know what? This, because we've been watching all of these movies, I mean, I know I've watched a lot more 2023 movies this year than I usually have, so it's kind of fun to talk about that. It's fun. I love this year-end recap because it really gets us talking about movies that we're not spending time on the podcast talking about otherwise.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and it was fun for me because I realized last year when we did this podcast, I had not seen a lot of the movies that ended up being nominated for Best Picture in 2022. So some of those movies appear not necessarily in my best five first watches or anything, but they started to show up and I said, oh, I forgot that I hadn't watched, you know, Tar or I can't even remember what else, but there were a couple of movies that I hadn't watched yet when we did this review. Whereas this year, I feel like I've gotten a good amount in, although I still haven't seen Saltburn, which is going to be our movie that we're doing for our next podcast. So that'll be next week. So you'll get to hear my take on Saltburn soon enough. Anyway, but so real quick, so that everybody can kind of follow along. And if you want to leave in the comments what yours are as well, we're going to be going through our best five first watches. That's any year. Doesn't matter what year the movie came out. It's just the best five first watches we had of any movie this year. We're going to be talking about our most disappointing movie, our most our biggest pleasant surprise. Again, those can be from any year. Movie that wasn't good as we remembered. So that's a movie that we've watched in the past, remembered enjoying, rewatched it, and don't remember it, and it wasn't as good. It didn't live up to the hype. Top three rewatches of movies not in our top 100. So John and I did our top 100 series. John has since changed his top 100. I have not done that. But we're going to be talking about movies that aren't in our top 100 now that we rewatched this year that will probably end up in our top 100. Worst movie we watched this year, again, can be from any year. Worst movie of 2023. So that obviously has to be from this year. Top five movies of 2023. And then we're also going to add in a best horror movie we watched this year, best comedy we watched this year, best drama we watched this year, and best action movie we watched this year. So those can be from any year. It can be a first watch or rewatch. It doesn't matter. It's just kind of movies that fit into that top billing. Jordan Alford's here, says, hello, guys. Still got a few more I need to see before I make my 2023 list. Yes, this is not our final official list. Follow me on Letterboxd. And John, I think you do your 2023 ranking on Letterboxd as well, right? Yeah. All right. I took up all the time. John, you got any thoughts?
No, nothing beyond. I mean, I have thoughts, but it's all based on what we're about to talk about. So I guess we could just get at it.
Yeah. All right. Let's jump in. So let's actually start off with these newer categories because we hadn't done the genre by genre ones. And let's start with the one that you were probably most excited to talk about. And let's do our best horror. So the only rule with the best horror movie we watched this year is that it can't be in our best five first watches and it can't be one of our top 100 movies. So it couldn't fit into another category that we have here. So really, this best horror movie could be my sixth or it could be my third favorite. No, I guess it would have to be my sixth favorite movie, but it could be my third favorite horror movie of the year. But if I had horror movies in my top five first watches, I couldn't put this in there. John, what was your best horror movie of the year?
I have been hot about this a little bit because there in October, I watched 42 horror movies. So I took it a lot this year and I was thinking about some of the more like artsy ones I saw, something like Possession with Sam Neill, which is a fantastic movie. But I ultimately landed on Phantasm,
which
is it's this movie about these this kid and his like older brother who find out that there's this strange thing going on at the local mortuary, and it's a bizarre movie. It is so much fun. Is it the scariest movie? No, but it's this perfect amount of this like late 70s, early 80s horror schlock that just makes it so enjoyable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I've never seen it. Honestly, I've heard of it, but I've never gotten around to it. And 80s are really like my least favorite decade. I talk about that all the time. The 80s are a really tough one for me. So I haven't gotten around to that one. I'm glad though, I actually went and looked at my top 50 horror movies because I said to myself, wait, did I watch a different one? I couldn't remember what I had ranked higher, The Babadook or Carnival of Souls. And the answer is The Babadook. So The Babadook is my best horror movie of the year, although for a second I thought it was going to be Carnival of Souls. But Carnival of Souls was my best first watch. I'd never seen that one before, whereas The Babadook I had seen before. But I really like The Babadook. I feel like it's one of those movies that gets a little overlooked now because it came out during that 2010 to 2015 range of a lot of really good indie horror movies coming out. And this was one of those that was Australian and got a little lost to time. But it's a really good story. It's, you know, it's kind of on the nose because, you know, at the end of the day, it's about like her with her kid and everything like that. But I really, really enjoy this movie. It creeps me out. I like the background of The Babadook, and the imagery in this movie is stunning. And I really, really appreciate that. So, yeah, I have The Babadook as my best horror movie of the year, although Raptor 8415 says I saw Carnival of Souls this year. Really good movie. Yeah, it's very, very interesting. And some of it is so creepy.
Yeah. I actually didn't watch Carnival of Souls yet, so I have to get on that one. Maybe it'll be my best horror movie of next year. But yeah. The Babadook is kind of that turning point that we talk about in horror a lot, as that, like, what brought about this new reign of elevated horror, right? Even so much where it's, like, referenced in Scream 5, like, multiple times.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Jennifer Kent, who directed it, really hasn't done much else that's had much success. No. Like, people don't really talk about Jennifer Kent that much, which is surprising because it's a really good movie.
I think it's really hard for movies to get out of Australia.
Yeah, that's fair. That's fair. I mean, it is kind of like a culture thing that America and, you know, because America is the biggest box office, America and Asia. And so there's a culture difference between that and Australia. And what like Americans find interesting about Australia is not when an Australian makes a normal movie. It's when people like get into the, you know, what Australia is as Australia. So yeah, that's it. Jordan says The Nightingale is great too by her. It's just not popular. And yeah, I mean, unfortunately that's kind of where she's at.
Mm-hmm.
What was your best comedy?
This one was really easy for me. It was actually one of my more recent watches. It's The Purple Rose of Cairo, which I'm pretty sure you mentioned last year in this podcast.
I did. That was one of my top. I think that was my top first watch of last year.
That movie, it just feels my like Woody Allen's on another level in that movie. He's just created this fantastic comedy, which I know it kind of gets a lot of flack for the ending, which is, I mean, pretty depressing.
Mm-hmm.
But I also really love that ending. I feel like it's the perfect cap to this movie. It was just phenomenal all the way through.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Purple Rose of Cairo. That was my third best first watch last year behind Tokyo Story and In the Bedroom. And I'm going to be honest with you. As time has gone on, I'd probably put In the Bedroom and The Purple Rose of Cairo above Tokyo Story just because of like how I like connect with those movies a little bit better. Purple Rose of Cairo is a great one. My comedy was tough because I didn't watch many good new comedies this year. And like, I don't really go out of my way to rewatch a lot of comedies. You know, like if a Will Ferrell movie's on TNT, I'll keep it on. But, you know, that's what it is. But I went with In Bruges. Finally watched In Bruges. And man, In Bruges is a tough one to even call a comedy because it's one of the darkest movies ever. I mean, it is so unbelievably dark. But it is funny. And Ralph Fiennes' performance in that movie is just on another level. So In Bruges is what I ultimately went with. Although that movie could have gone into my movie that wasn't as good as I remembered category, because even though I gave it 3.5 stars and I really, really enjoy it, I remember when I first saw that being like, oh my God, is this in my top 100? And then it wasn't. So it's not close. So In Bruges is my best comedy of the year. Valier says, I will always love The Descent. That's going back to horror. And I need to mention that because The Descent is probably the most underrated horror film ever made. So, all right, John, I'll go first on the next two so that you can hear my takes first. And, you know, that's it. Best drama. So this one's tough because pretty much what's in our top five movies is going to be mostly drama. And really any movie can land in drama unless it's a slapstick comedy. I went with Tar. So when we had done this podcast last year, I hadn't seen Tar. And Tar last year, let me take a look real quick, because where did that end up on my list? It ended up, I remember being really mad when she didn't win Best Actress, Cate Blanchett, because she ended up losing to Michelle Yeoh, who Michelle Yeoh is fine, but Cate Blanchett is just, she's a powerhouse in that movie. And so what was my 2022 ranked? I ended up with that as my third favorite movie of last year, behind just Banshees and The Northman. But I hadn't been able to talk about it when we were here. And I think that Todd Field did a phenomenal job with that movie. Jordan says he hated it. I loved it. It was just one of those movies where it's very dark and it's just like so professionally made. And I'm a big Todd Field fan. As I said, In the Bedroom was my number two of last year. And he also did Little Children, which I think is arguably the most underrated movie of the 2000s. Nobody talks about that movie, and the performances and the storytelling and everything like that is just incredible. So yeah, I ended up going with Tar here, and there were a couple options I could have went with, but that was the one that I just landed on. I'm trying to find my, I got to get my list back up here. The other one that I was thinking of doing would have been Sancho the Bailiff, which is a Japanese movie, which was by Kenji Mizoguchi. So that was one that I considered, but Tar ultimately is higher in my best movies I watched for the first time in 2023. So I had to put it here.
Yeah, I mean, Tar, we raved about it when we were doing our Best Pictures discussions last year. It was a phenomenal film. Probably my second favorite from last year, all things considered, afterwards, because I also didn't watch it until 2023. Mm-hmm. But it was... it was a powerhouse film, like you said. Like, Cate Blanchett in that movie is just spectacular. Just completely on her A game. It's got this, like, weird amount of tension to it the entire movie. And that ending is just so beautiful.
Yeah, I really like that ending. What was your best drama, John?
I went with The Best Years of Our Lives.
Wow, I'm surprised you liked The Best Years of Our Lives. I didn't even know you watched The Best Years of Our Lives.
I watched it a couple of weeks ago, and I really enjoyed this movie. I was kind of shocked by it, too, but it just watching these three lives of these men who were in the war, they've come back, and they're just trying to reacclimate to society again, it's fascinating. I understand why it ends up on like AFI's top 100. It was just a movie that really investigated the human condition in a time when, you know, I think we're still at a point where America doesn't really acknowledge veterans the way they do in this movie.
I agree with that. And it's fascinating because The Best Years of Our Lives generally comes up on the list of movies that shouldn't have won Best Picture because it beat It's a Wonderful Life, which is fair. I mean, It's a Wonderful Life is a great movie. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, and I gotta make sure I get this right because I can't sound like a fool in front of everybody. So just give me one quick moment here. But did it also beat, what else did it beat? It also beat, here we go. It beat, oh no, it didn't. Okay, for some reason I was thinking Treasure of the Sierra Madre came out that year. Actually, that year I've seen three of the Best Picture nominees with It's a Wonderful Life, The Best Years of Our Lives, and The Razor's Edge. The Razor's Edge is very okay. But yeah, The Best Years of Our Lives, I enjoy that movie. I haven't seen it in a long time. I have it ranked as my 47th best picture winner out of the 96, which I finished my best picture winners this year. So I was able to actually have a complete list. But it's at 47, and I gave it 3.5 stars. So I really like the Best Picture winners. That's like how much of a film fan I am that I can do that. I could see that rising on a rewatch, especially since I've really gotten such a bigger love for William Wyler. I've started to see more of his movies, and like a movie like Dodsworth, which nobody talks about, from 1936. I gave that 4 stars when I watched it last year, and that's just a movie that was so ahead of its time and so good. And he did Roman Holiday, Ben-Hur. I haven't seen Funny Girl, Jezebel, which is another one from 1938. So William Wyler has done a lot of really good movies. And Best Years of Our Lives is a kind of a shocking one. And what's his name? Harold Russell always gets talked about as like one of the worst best supporting actor winners. And I feel like that's such a bad take. I feel like it's such a bad take. I think Harold Russell really does give a great, great performance in that movie. And I really enjoyed it. Jordan, I just want to throw in Jordan's here. He says, I recommend you watch Five Came Back. It's a great documentary on how World War II affected our greatest filmmakers at that time. Some of them even served and did propaganda films. And then he said, to be frank, the Oscars are right more often than people give them credit for. Unfortunately, when they miss, they really miss. And that is for sure.
True.
When they miss, they do miss. What was I going to say? Oh, another one though, John, I don't know if you've seen it or not yet, but you should check out From Here to Eternity. I actually prefer From Here to Eternity over that, but that's another one that kind of looks at World War II, except it's before the bombing of Pearl Harbor rather than after war happened. So yeah. All right. Last one. Best action movie. And I'm going with The Gray. This is a movie I wanted to talk about on this podcast for a very long time. I love The Gray. I remember when The Gray came out, I was in college and we went and saw it in theaters. And I remember just absolutely loving that movie. It's just a pure survival action movie. And it is so entertaining. And you have Liam Neeson giving a really good performance. It's a guy's movie. It's essentially the opposite of The Descent. It's all guys after a plane crash, and they have to survive in the wide open vast wilderness, as opposed to The Descent, which is all women who go spelunking and now have to survive the caves. And rather than creatures, you're getting wolves. What a good action movie this is. I highly recommend it. It's a tough one to find. I don't know if the release on it was just bad. I really don't remember. I know people were disappointed by the ending when it came out, which is kind of ridiculous to look back. They really wanted Liam Neeson to fight a bunch of wolves. They wanted to see that on screen. Like, that's not what this movie is. But it's dark, it's gritty, and it's a really, 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 really good movie. And I highly recommend people watch that.
Wait, that movie isn't about Liam Neeson fighting a bunch of wolves? Because I always thought that's what that movie was about.
No, the movie is a survival movie, and there's wolves that are, you know, attacking them and doing whatever throughout. But at the end of the movie, there's a part where like you get the idea of how this movie is going to end. You don't need to see Liam Neeson fight wolves at the very end of the movie. And people are like, well, we wanted to see him fight wolves. And it's like, you do realize how corny and stupid that would be, right? But anyway.
Yeah, but that's how they feel about Liam Neeson. I mean, look at the roles that Liam Neeson takes. You see a movie about Liam Neeson and wolves, and you figure he's just punching wolves the entire time.
I know. It was way more of a movie than I thought it was going to be when I first watched it. And when I rewatched it, it lived up to the hype that was living in my brain.
Interesting. Like, I've never seen it. And it was because I was under the impression it was just Liam Neeson fighting a bunch of wolves. So maybe I'll have to give it a watch.
It's a good one. It's about masculinity and being men. You know, it's that kind of thing.
Wonderful.
What's your best action, John?
I have a bit of a story for my best action, because this year I spent a lot of time going through a lot of series. And watching them like from start to finish. I watched all the Star Trek movies. I watched all of the Friday the 13th. I watched all of the Nightmare on Elm Street. And it all actually stemmed from the series rewatch that I did that started it all, because I had to subscribe to Paramount Plus and I didn't want to waste a month of a subscription. It's Mission Impossible Fallout. So the sixth Mission Impossible movie, I did a Mission Impossible rewatch building up to the release of Dead Reckoning Part 1, and Fallout was one that I didn't see because it came out in 2018 when I was living in the middle of nowhere. This movie, it's astounding how fantastic the Mission Impossible series really is and how consistent it is as an action series. It has, you know, the one dud in Mission Impossible 2, but Fallout, it takes everything that's been built up to at that point. It's giving you villains who you're aware of in the universe already, and Henry Cavill is phenomenal as the big bad in this movie.
Yeah, I really like Fallout. I mean, the Mission Impossible movies to me are very, very entertaining. So, you know, I really do enjoy them. It kind of made me realize that The Gray wasn't my actual answer because I watched The Spy Who Loved Me. So,
Yeah, that's fair.
Thanks, John. I forgot all about the James Bond movies. Yeah. So I should have put The Spy Who Loved Me in there, but I didn't. And I kind of forgot that I was rewatching all of those this year because we just got to the end of the Roger Moore phase. So we're about to get into Timothy Dalton, which is nice, but that means I definitely watched The Spy Who Loved Me this year. And that's my favorite of the James Bond movies. And that's a 4-star movie, which The Gray I gave 3.5. So I lied to all of you moments ago.
Yeah.
Anyway, let's change it up and go to the worst movie we watched this year. Ooh. This can be from any year. What'd you got?
Well, Phil, I made a very bold choice this year and decided to rewatch The Happening. And let me tell you, that movie is even worse than you remember it being.
I mean, John, I'm right there with you because as I did my Planet of the Apes rewatch, I did Planet of the Apes 2001, and that movie was so much worse than I remembered it being. And there's just some movies that really are as bad as advertised. And The Happening and Planet of the Apes from 2001 are two of those movies.
Yeah, they really are. It's just this movie. You remember all the, like, The Happening came out at a time where, like, memes were really starting to pick up on the internet, and we got a lot of them. I mean, the plot is, like, the trees did it. Actually, the plot, it's suggested early in the movie, and you're like, that can't literally be it, but it's it. Mm-hmm. The performances are horrid. Mark Wahlberg is so bad in this movie. Mm-hmm. And it kind of stemmed off last year when I rewatched The Village, and I was like, oh, man, this movie's actually a lot better than I remember it. So maybe, like, The Happening isn't as bad. But it was worse, and I didn't think that was possible.
Yeah, The Village started to get hate just because The Village was M. Night Shyamalan, and people were getting tired of, like, the M. Night Shyamalan shtick. But The Village is actually a very good movie. The first four movies by M. Night Shyamalan are very good, with The Sixth Sense, which I think is overrated, but it's still a good movie. Unbreakable, The Village, and Signs. Those are four really good movies. It's everything after that that he just becomes a disaster.
I don't know which one he released this year, actually, I think, because Knock at the Cabin was really surprising for me how much I enjoyed it.
Yeah, I actually didn't mind Old. I know a lot of people thought that was, like, stupid, but I didn't mind Old. I thought it was okay. I mean, he's okay here and that, but Raptor 8415 says Mark Wahlberg is so bad in that movie that it almost loops back around to being funny. It gets close.
But it doesn't quite, and that's the problem, is that it doesn't quite get to funny.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Save Our Planet Entertainment says, just stopping in to say my favorite movie of this year was Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse, but the best movie I saw this year was Oppenheimer. I have not seen Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse, but I do think I'm going to end up having to see that movie because I think that might sneak in with an Oscar nomination, John. I think it might get
the best nomination. At the worst, it's getting Best Animated Picture nomination.
And it's going to win that, probably.
Probably. There's a Miyazaki film.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, and The Boy and the Heron is getting praised right now. But Raptor 8415 wants me to just call him Raptor, but the 8415 is there. I need to say 8415. Jordan says The Happening is hilarious. I remember joking my cousin after we saw it about making sure we talk to the trees every day. So, John, do you talk to the trees every day?
No, I don't. Mostly because there aren't that many trees around me because I live in a city now and not the middle of nowhere. But, it's just I don't even know how to feel about that movie. Because it's just so painful to watch.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I haven't seen that since it came out, and I don't plan on ever rewatching it. And Planet of the Apes from 2001 was a movie I only rewatched because I was rewatching every single Planet of the Apes movie, and it came up. I said, how bad can it be? Oh, my God. Oh, my God. It's the worst movie I've ever seen in my entire life, and I'm not exaggerating. It's the worst movie I've ever seen in my entire life.
I got so curious about it after, you know, we read Planet of the Apes and you were talking about it so much. I was like, I need to watch this. But you kept after you rewatched it, you harked on so how bad it was.
Mm-hmm.
I just couldn't bring myself to do it. Like, you actually said it was the worst movie you've ever seen. Mm-hmm. How am I supposed to sit down and watch that movie and try to take it seriously?
I mean, here's all you need to know about that movie for anybody listening who hasn't seen it. The humans talk.
That's dumb. Oh my God. What?
The humans talk the entire movie. So it's like, okay, so why did the apes completely take over? It's so dumb.
That completely ruins the purpose of Planet of the Apes. Yeah,
it absolutely does. It absolutely does.
Oh my God.
So, all right. What was your worst movie of this year, John?
Oh, easy. It's okay. Maybe it's not easy because we saw some pretty bad ones that we bought about this year. We saw Five Nights at Freddy's, which was terrible.
Which is my worst movie of 2023.
There you go. Gran Turismo, which I kind of forgot about how bad it was until it was brought up at a Christmas conversation I was in this week, where someone told them, my brother-in-law was talking to people, and they said they enjoyed it so much when they watched it on a plane, they had to watch it again. And I don't know how you watch that movie two times, but it has to be Cocaine Bear.
Oh, I didn't see Cocaine Bear, but that's funny because I actually really love those style of movies. So I
feel like I love those. I do too. I love those styles of movies. This one is so bad that like it doesn't get to a point where it's super funny. Because this should be, the concept of this movie should lend itself to being this hilarious, schlocky B movie. And it's just not. It's just so terrible.
Mm. Okay. I haven't seen it yet. I felt like Elizabeth Banks would get it because she did Slither. And that is one of my favorite B movies, but maybe she doesn't. But I haven't seen it. And honestly, people didn't talk about it that much. So it kind of like fell off my radar.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Jordan's, I mean,
go ahead.
Sorry, it had hype leading up to its release, and then everyone immediately stopped talking about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Jordan said The Flash was definitely his least favorite hot offensive garbage. Did you see it?
I did. It was also pretty bad. It was impressive how bad it was. My biggest complaint about that movie is like 25% recycled material from other DCEU movies.
Mm. Yeah, I'll never watch that because we're never going to go through the DCEU movies. So I don't have to.
It's over now. The DCEU is done with the release of Aquaman this week.
Oh, that was his last one?
That was the official of the Snyderverse. It's officially over now. And now we go into the James Gunn era of DC movies.
Oh, man. My goodness. Okay, let's move on. That just makes me sad across the board. But anyway, let's do our movie that wasn't good as we remembered. So this is a tough one because this has to be a movie you kind of liked and then you didn't. Yeah. And for me, it's a 3-star movie, but it's The French Connection because I remember loving that movie when I was younger. And then I watched it this year. The ending to that movie is one of the worst endings a Best Picture has ever had. I mean, it's up there with Coda in terms of bad Best Picture winning endings. And I remember Coda's ending being really bad, even though it's really not that bad. It's just Coda in general is such a steaming pile of shit. But The French Connection's ending is so, 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 so bad and comes out of nowhere. And it's so rushed and so forced. I mean, I really appreciate the freaking direction. His direction is phenomenal. The acting from Gene Hackman is great. Schneider, I can never say his, Roy Scheider is so good. But it was not as good as I remembered. I gave it 3 stars and I might have been being generous.
Yeah, I watched that for the first time, I think 2 years ago, and I didn't see the hype around the movie. Mm-hmm. And then I read the book and I still didn't see the hype around the movie.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and the thing is, when you look at that year, man, you had what do you call it? The Clockwork Orange was that year as well. The Last Picture Show was that year, which I know you're not a huge fan of, but very stylized year. Yeah. And The French Connection is stylized, but it's nowhere near as good as the stylized versions of Stanley Kubrick or Peter Bogdanovich. So
that's just my opinion. Yeah.
What do you got?
This is a tough one because like you said, this is a really tough category because it has to be something we've A, watched before and B, liked. So I actually rewatched The Mummy Returns this year for the first time since I was a kid, probably. And I used to watch that movie on repeat in my teenage years. And I loved that movie as a kid, but it is not great. It's not great at all. It has some of the charm of 1999's The Mummy.
No, it doesn't.
Which, I mean, if you want to hear us talk about, subscribe to the Patreon because you'll hear us talk about it in a couple weeks.
It's coming in a couple weeks, yeah.
But it gives you this child actor as the semi-lead. And he's fine, but there's so much bad CGI in that movie. It's not like 1999's The Mummy where it's kind of charming in that late 90s way. Mm-hmm. It's like, oh, we're still doing this?
Oh, you can't look at The Rock in that movie.
Oh, no. It's impossible. He looks so bad. And the plot's just not great. The chase around. It has that fun element, but it's just not as fun as I remembered it being.
I gave it exactly 1 star. In 2001, my 9-year-old self made my dad turn off our Blockbuster rental halfway through. 9-year-old me is smarter than current me. It's like every producer, writer, and director just sat around listing out 100 things they wanted to see in a sequel. And then with those thousands of ideas, they decided to cut zero and try to fit it all into 129 minutes. Simply, it is not coherent. It is not. Oh, simple. It is not coherent. Is not fun. It is not. For a movie with a monster budget, there may be nothing more embarrassing than the Scorpion King at the end. The video game that came out a few years later looked better. That is my review for The Mummy Returns, which I gave 1 star.
Wow. I didn't even go that low on it, and I think that is because of the childhood nostalgia.
Yeah.
But yeah, it just doesn't live up to its predecessor at all.
No, it does not. It really does not. And we will be talking about The Mummy in that releases on January 9th for patrons. So if you become a patron, patreon.com/thespecialist, The Mummy will be our $5 Tuesday on January 9th, the second episode in that series. Jordan said he saw The Exorcist in a theater for the first time ever. Definitely his favorite first time watch this year. That's awesome.
That's awesome.
Like I'd love to see The Exorcist in a theater. I got to start seeing the movies that they re-release randomly in theaters. Just kind of with the point. Go ahead.
I was going to say they've kind of stopped doing that around here, and it's kind of made me mad.
Yeah, I know. And that's kind of like what the point with our $5 Tuesdays is like, it's those movies where you could go, they re-release them, they throw them in, it's $5, it doesn't cost you anything, and you can go see it. Like I saw Lawrence of Arabia that way. I know they used to do the Indiana Jones movies that way. They've done Star Wars movies. So that's kind of what we're looking at as we do our $5 Thursdays, which we talked about. Mean Girls will be releasing on January 2nd. So just in a couple days, that podcast next Tuesday will be the first one. And that'll be available to YouTube viewers as well. It won't just go on Patreon. So you can kind of get a taste of what John and I are going to be doing. But honestly, those conversations aren't going to be all that much different than what we're talking about now. So, you know, you should be able to
figure it out. It'll be fun. Because
if you like us, you like us. If you don't, you don't.
Exactly.
Oh, man. All right. Sorry. I got like, if I sit too hunched for too long, my back kills me. Then I have to keep taking deep breaths and everybody thinks I'm yawning at you, John, but I'm not yawning at you. I literally am not getting the oxygen into my back. All right. What was your pleasant surprise of this
show? Okay. So for people who know this movie, they're probably going to ask, how was this your pleasant surprise? So there is a bit of a story. And during November, it's Noir-vember, and I realized there are not a lot of like easily searchable noir films on streaming services. Mm-hmm. They're kind of hard to find if you're not using Canopy. And I was on Amazon, and this one popped up, and I was like, sure, I'll watch this. It was Out of the Past, and that movie is phenomenal.
Yeah.
And as a movie that just like randomly showed up on my Amazon Prime, to watch it, not really expecting much, and for it to be just like one of the best film noirs ever made, it really surprised me.
Yeah, Out of the Past is great. Out of the Past is one of those movies that absolutely lives up to the hype. It is such a good movie. Kirk Douglas is great in that. God, what is the name of the lead actor in that?
I can't remember.
Why am I drawing a blank? Somebody's going to yell at us. By the time I type it in, somebody will have typed it, but you're on a delay, guys. I'm not. Robert Mitchum. Yeah, Robert Mitchum is great. Like that's just a really, really good noir movie. Very underrated though, because it was made by by Jacques Tornier, who had done Cat People, but wasn't really like, he never became a big success in the US. So that movie gets kind of overlooked. It's kind of like when with The Deer Hunter with Cimino.
Yeah.
Or Cimino never became something. So The Deer Hunter doesn't get discussed the way a Scorsese movie might, because you're not going to accidentally find that movie when you're trying to go through a filmography. And that's kind of what happens here with this guy with Out of the Past. But that is a very good movie.
Yeah. Yeah. I was thorough. It's one of those movies that you kind of throw on in the background, and then you're like, I threw it on the background, and I found myself just like completely entranced by it the entire time.
Yeah. You know what I'm going to go with? Thanksgiving.
Oh, yeah. That's a good one.
I thought that trailer, I was like, okay, cool. It's Eli Roth. He's going to be bad. That is such a well-made movie. I was so happy with that movie. I was so impressed the entire time. I was laughing. I was cringing. I had a really fun time sitting in that movie theater next to the two women who were next to me, who were older and were so gleeful every time somebody got a part of their body chopped off. That was by far the biggest pleasant surprise. I never thought that movie was going to be good. And it really, really was. And it was so worth the watch. And if you haven't seen Thanksgiving yet, watch it. And also listen to our podcast about it.
Yeah. I mean, Thanksgiving was just such a fun ride. It was everything you expected out of an Eli Roth slasher film. And it kind of delivered more than that, which was kind of nice.
Yeah. It really did. It really did. So that was my pleasant surprise. What was your most disappointing movie? I think mine's going to kind of surprise you a little bit. So, you know, click here to learn more.
Ooh. I went for two. I went for two because one came out this year and one didn't come out this year. So the one that came out this year was the Super Mario Bros. Movie. That's actually one of my lowest rated movies from 2023 because it didn't have a plot. It didn't have characters. It was just a 2-hour children's movie. Like, it was completely made for children, and I was really hoping for more out of it. I was hoping for it to be something that reached, like, cross-generational, maybe something, like, closer to, like, a Shrek. Mm-hmm. But in the end, it was just a children's movie.
Yeah. Didn't see it. What was your other one?
The other one, I watched American Hustle for the first time.
Oh, my God, I hate that movie.
That movie is so bad. And it got so much hype when it came out. Like, so because of all that hype, I thought it would be good. I thought it would be entertaining. And it's just every aspect of that movie falls flat. The performances aren't great. The story itself is, like, fine, but not really engaging enough to sustain the length of the film.
Yeah, Jennifer Lawrence won Best Supporting Actress for that, or was she just nominated?
Can't remember.
Because I think she won for Silver Linings. Okay, let's see. American Hustle. No, it didn't win anything. That's right. It didn't win anything because that was it, like, ended up tying with, I think it tied with what was it? Shawshank Redemption for most nominations without a win. Because she was nominated, and it was because of the love people had for her for Silver Linings Playbook. But right. I hate American Hustle. I hate that movie. Mm-hmm. I hated it when it came out. And I'm a big David O. Russell fan. I love Three Kings. I like Silver Linings Playbook. I don't love Silver Linings Playbook, but I like Silver Linings Playbook. And I think The Fighter is probably a top 5, top 10 sports movie ever made. Mm-hmm. Like, Christian Bale's performance in The Fighter is absolutely ridiculous. I love those movies. So for me, when American Hustle came out and I watched it, I just felt numb the entire time. The movie starts to pick up a little bit for me when they start singing that Why Delilah song, that part. Right. And then it starts to pick up a little bit for me after that. But the first hour, I was just like, where the hell am I and why am I there? I was just not into it at all. And it just lost me.
Yeah. Yeah, it just doesn't quite get there. It doesn't get to a point where it's like, this is spectacular. It just keeps in, like, this realm of mediocrity the entire time.
And maybe Jordan says we're wrong objectively. She was nominated. He's talking about Jennifer Lawrence there. Maybe The Fighter is a movie we need to do at some point because The Fighter is so underrated. Mm-hmm. Our buddy Steve, that's his least favorite movie of all time, but he's never been more wrong about anything in his entire life.
Okay. Oh, I'm interested.
You haven't seen it?
No, I haven't.
Oh. I mean, it's essentially Rocky if everybody around Rocky was addicted to drugs and a piece of shit.
Oh, so a more realistic Rocky.
Yes. Yes. And that's why they're not building statues of Mickey Ward. So, you know.
Okay.
But anyway. All right. My most disappointing movie was Doctor Strange, which might shock some people because I've been very open about how I hate the MCU. I think it's stupid. I don't like most of it. However, I really, really, really was excited for this one. I talked about it previously. It was the one trailer for a Marvel movie that actually got my interest. I sat down and I watched Doctor Strange's trailer and I said, wow, that actually looks like a good movie. That looks pretty cool. And then I watched it this time. And I said, oh my goodness, that is nonsense. So that was my most disappointing movie. It's really the only Marvel movie that could disappoint me, which is really funny because it did. And there were some surprises in there, but this was the only one that I thought, oh, that actually seems like a cool concept. And then it dropped itself on its skull. So yeah.
I mean, you obviously you could have all of Phil's thoughts by watching our podcast about that, but it's so CGI riddled that it's so impossible to pay attention to what else is happening.
It's rough. It's really, really rough. All right. So now what we have left is our best five first watches, our top five movies of 2023, and our top three rewatches of movies not in our top 100. So the top three rewatches of movies not in the top 100 for me are interesting because I haven't updated my top 100. You've updated yours, so people don't necessarily know. So let's start with that one, and I'll do mine first because two of them – so one is The Father, which I rewatched this year, which is going to be in my top 100, and I can't now not have it be here. Number two, which I watched yesterday, which I texted you after and said this might be my favorite Kubrick movie, which is saying so much – because I had Doctor Strangelove in my top 15. is Paths of Glory, which was in my top three rewatches of movies, not my top 100 last year. So now I've watched it 2 years in a row and it continues to live up to that hype. So I already talked about Paths of Glory a bunch, but number one, and the one that I am 100% putting into my top 100 and will probably be in my top 20, maybe even higher, is Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf? And I hadn't seen this movie in years. I watched when I went, when I was younger, I went through and watched all of the AFI top 100 movies. And I remember really liking Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, but I probably watched it when I was like 20, 21. So I didn't totally get it. And watching it this time, they are so mean to each other. Mm-hmm. The performances are so incredible. Sandy Dennis won the Oscar, rightfully so, for this movie. Richard Burton should have won the Oscar. And I mean, Elizabeth Taylor gives what I believe is the greatest female performance, maybe greatest performance, just regardless of gender, of all time. I love this movie. The score made it into my top 100 on Spotify this year. Sunday, all day, tomorrow, or tomorrow, Sunday, all day, whatever that's called, the main title score made it into my top 100 on Spotify this year. And that doesn't even include that I listened to it about 45 times on YouTube because I didn't realize it was on Spotify immediately after watching that movie. So it probably would have been in like my top 10 songs listened to this year. It's just a brutal, brutal movie about, you know, depression and alcoholism and just feeling unfulfilled and wanting more, but not knowing how to gain it and aging and just absolutely unforgiving. One of the greatest movies ever made, hands down. So that's, those are my three. Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, Paths of Glory, The Father. All three of them are going to end up in my top 100. Let's be real. But Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf is the only one I haven't really gotten to talk about on this podcast. So there you go.
After you watch Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf and you exclaimed everything you just said about it to me, I watched it and it was a first watch for me. So spoiler alert, that's going to show up for me, but it's just a phenomenal film. It is so well structured. It's for such a contained story. It feels so much bigger than it is. It just floors you with how well done it's made.
Yeah. It's just devastating. It really is. And so when I do my, I have lists on Letterboxd, if you haven't checked it out, of my best actors, my best actresses, best supporting actress, out of all the ones I've seen. I haven't seen them all, but I do have Elizabeth Taylor as the best actress winner I've ever seen. And I had Sandy Dennis. Let me see where I had Sandy Dennis. Sandy Dennis, I have ranked 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. I have her ranked 7th. And honestly, she could probably be higher, but some of those I might be forgetting. Best supporting actress is an interesting one as you go through and you watch these movies, because you start to see, like, back in the day, best supporting actresses were barely even in the movies that they were winning for. And nowadays they're getting these meaty roles where they're essentially the lead. Anna Paquin, you know, she's literally the entire movie. So it becomes tough to, like, properly rank those. But I end up having Sandy Dennis at number 7, right after Monique, who I think is super underrated and precious, and right above Tatum O'Neal for Paper Moon, who Ryan O'Neal passed away earlier this year, which was a sad thing. Jordan Alford says, Mike Nichols needs to be talked about more as an all-time great. He absolutely does. The problem with Mike Nichols is he only really has, what, 3 or 4 great movies. I mean, he has 2 all-time classics with The Graduate and Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. But then after that, there is a significant drop-off with him, even though his movies, he still has other really good movies, such as Closer and, oh man, I'm drawing a blank on this other one. Carnal Knowledge is pretty good. Catch 22, you know. So he has some other good ones, but those two are just so much better than everything else.
So my top 3 rewatches, not in my top 100, I made sure to not include anything in either my original top 100 or my adjusted top 100. So these are, and I don't think any of these will end up in my top 100 moving forward. One of them I was considering for my latest iteration and I decided not to put it there. But the first one, I talked about how Mission Impossible Fallout was the best action movie I watched this year, but it's not even the best Mission Impossible movie, because Mission Impossible 3 is really, really good. And that caught me by surprise, because I remember not really liking it when I first saw it in theaters. And rewatching it now, Philip Seymour Hoffman is a force in that movie. He is so intimidating. He is easily the best villain in any Mission Impossible movie. J.J. Abrams' direction, which I give a lot of flack to because I think J.J. Abrams is kind of a hack, but he got it right in this movie. The way that the film structured, the way that it's structured with like this scene from the middle of the movie at the beginning and then flashes back to lead up to that scene, it really works in this movie, and it's the most personal Mission Impossible movie. It gives us so much more character for Ethan Hunt. It's just fantastic. I loved it all the way through. My second was Hellraiser, which is getting really close to my top 100. The first time I watched it, I was like, this is a 3. When I rewatched it this year, this is an all-time horror movie, for sure. It is so fascinating, this idea of this woman who is having an affair with a man who's dead and is like trying to bring him back to life because she accidentally does so. It's so fascinating. It's so well done. The practical effects in that movie are top notch. It is horrifying, and it hits it so out of the park. And at number one, which was the one that I was considering for my top 100 this time around, Shin Godzilla. I rewatched it after Godzilla Minus One this year because I wanted to figure out which one I liked more. We'll talk about which one that actually was later. But Shin Godzilla is this fascinating look at Japanese bureaucracy and how it doesn't respond quickly enough. It's really interesting watching it in a post-COVID world to see how world governments just don't respond to crises as quickly as they should. Mm-hmm. And I mean, look who directed it. Obviously, Anno makes a film. I'm going to love it because I love Evangelion so much. And yes, I'll give everyone this. The design of Godzilla in that movie is ridiculous. But it is still like this terrifying Godzilla. And the look at the Japanese government is just fascinating.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I haven't seen that. I haven't seen that one. And I haven't seen Hellraiser, actually. I got to watch Hellraiser. Mm-hmm. I haven't seen either of those. But yeah, I'll have to check them out now that they're on your top three rewatches. And Mission Impossible 3, I do enjoy quite a bit. I really enjoy all the Mission Impossibles except for the second one. Yeah. The second one is so bad.
Yeah.
All right, let's do our top five movies of 2023 just because we've talked about these movies so much, and then we'll get into our best five first watches. So this is as of December 29th, 2023. So there's still things that could change, obviously. There's movies I haven't seen. I'll go through mine real quick because these are movies that we've done a podcast on, every single one of them. At number five, I have Bottoms. At number four, I have Oppenheimer. At number three, I have Killers of the Flower Moon. At two, I have Godzilla Minus One. And at number one, I have The Holdovers. The one that I thought would have ended up on my list that didn't was Poor Things. And Poor Things, I couldn't bring myself to put it into that tier. So yeah, I mean, we talked about that a little bit. Was I a little disappointed with Poor Things? Yeah. I still gave it 3.5 stars, but I really thought that was going to be a top five movie for me, hands down. And it didn't get there. So Bottoms, Oppenheimer, Killers of the Flower Moon, Godzilla Minus One, and The Holdovers. And The Holdovers is the only movie that's actually my best five first watches of the year.
See, I actually kept my number one from my top from 2023 off of my best five first watches, despite the fact that it's probably number one in that list too.
Okay.
But I've been raving about that movie all year, so everyone should probably know what it is
already. Which is Past Lives.
Yeah, of course it is. Past Lives. I rewatched it. I made my family watch it on Christmas. Let me tell you, very sad movie to watch on Christmas, but I didn't care because it was my favorite movie of the year. And watching it again this week just solidified that it is so much better than every other movie that came out this year, in my opinion. It hits me on a completely different level. Two was Godzilla Minus One. Three was The Holdovers. Four is Killers of the Flower Moon. Five is a movie that we haven't actually discussed in this podcast and got a lot of very mixed reviews. It's Beau Is Afraid. Ari Aster's latest, which a lot of people really didn't like.
But yeah, that was one that was in and out and not talked about. That just done, moving on. Like, I was surprised with that.
Yeah, it's a weird movie. It is a bizarre movie. It really shows Ari Aster made such a name for himself with Hereditary and Midsommar that he could
make this for for you, John, so that you have to sit there and talk about Ari Aster while Jordan just is taunting you in the bottom corner.
But he was given free reign with this movie. No one pulled him in. It is bizarre. It is weird. It feels completely... I don't even know how to perfectly describe this movie. It's kind of something you just have to watch. There's a... And towards the end, I understand if you get turned off this movie. I get that. But it was so delightfully bizarre to me that I just love it so much.
Yeah, I have liked... I loved Hereditary. I hated Midsommar. And I was not running out to see Beau Is Afraid.
Yeah, sure.
That's where I'm at. That's where I'm at. But Jordan says, talk about hacks. Once Upon an Island jumps in and says, I love the new branding. Thank you, Once Upon an Island. Appreciate it. We put in a lot of hard work and effort. So I'm glad that it is going noticed. And all right, we are to our best five first watches of the year. So we'll kind of alternate back and forth. We'll start with number five and work our way up to our best. My number five, I've been going through the box set and it has taken me 2 years now and I'm barely 12 movies in, but I am going through the Ingmar Bergman movies. And so my number five, the best one I watched for the first time this year was Scenes from a Marriage. I watched both versions and gave both versions reviews because I think that that is important to do. So the way that they do it in the box set is I think it starts with the TV series and then it goes into the real movie. So I watched both versions and I actually did end up preferring the, where is it? I got to make sure. Yeah. I ended up preferring the movie version, believe it or not. Yeah. So yeah, that's yeah, it's a good one. It's a good one, but it's funny because as you'll see, as we go through this, my movies are, there's two movies that are pretty much the same movie that are in my top series here. So,
I wonder where those could be.
Yeah. Yeah. You'll see. But anyway, so yeah, my number five was Scenes from a Marriage, lives up to the hype. Really great depiction. Both versions are really good. So actually, no. So I like the mini series more, but I can't really consider that a movie, right? I'm rereading my review to make sure I understand this. So I like the miniseries more, but it can't really count it as a movie. So the movie still ends up here as my number five. It's really well done. It tightens up like what is 6 hours long and makes it 3 hours, but it cuts out one scene that I think is just so unbelievably important to the movie or to the miniseries that they should have kept it.
Yeah, it's really hard judging that because Bergman has a couple movies like that too, right? Where there's the miniseries version and then the film version. And a lot of people seem to think that the miniseries versions are better for them.
So, yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. It's hard to consider it. I think generally, you know what? If it's shorter than Son and Tango, you can probably consider it a movie still.
Yeah, that's true. There's a scene though where Liv Ullmann is like reading a thing to her, you know, they're divorced or whatever, and she's reading it to him from her diary. And it's so raw and everything's going and she looks over and he's fast asleep. And it's like the greatest scene I've ever seen in a movie. It's just unbelievable. So that's my number five. What was your number five?
My number five was something I actually watched pretty recently. That's Sergio Leone's Once Upon a Time in America.
Oh yeah. That's a great movie. So long,
so worth every minute of it. Maybe except for like that one scene, but it is such a phenomenal film. I wasn't sure. I thought it would kind of be your typical gangster movie leading into it, but it's so much better than that.
It's more about the friendship and all of that stuff. James Woods is so good in that movie. I know like he's not really a household name at this point, but he is so damn good in that movie.
Yeah, James Woods is phenomenal. Robert De Niro. I this was the movie where I was like, okay, I'm ready to admit Robert De Niro might be one of the best actors of all time.
Yeah.
And this might not even be his best performance, but just looking at the catalog of films he made in that like 10-year span, he's just so phenomenal. And the depictions in this, when we take like the Godfather 2 approach to a movie and we like flash back to an earlier time, it can go, you know, either way. But the way it's handled in this movie, where it goes back to their childhood and it really establishes the friendship of this group of friends, it leads to such a huge impact as this film goes on. It's just phenomenal. The fact that Sergio Leone can make the best Western movie and arguably the best gangster movie at the same time, it just goes to show how underappreciated he really is as a director.
Yeah. No, I totally agree. I totally agree. Yeah, that's an underrated one, and a lot of it is because length just cuts people out of it. But it is such a good movie. Yep. My number four is Scenes from a Marriage, but in 1979, which is Kramer versus Kramer.
Okay.
So I actually give the nod to Kramer versus Kramer. I, you know, Kramer versus Kramer is one of those movies that gets talked about and, you know, isn't really well thought of in the same way as those other 70s Best Picture winners. I would almost argue that it's the forgotten 70s Best Picture winner. It was the last Best Picture winner I saw. Mm-hmm. And the hype around it was always like, yeah, it's depressing and it's about a divorce. It is so damn good. It earned every Oscar. I mean, Apocalypse Now is a better movie, so maybe it didn't earn every Oscar it won. I mean, Francis Ford Coppola should have won Best Director over Robert Benton. But it is such a great, 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 great movie. Dustin Hoffman, Meryl Streep are phenomenal. The kid actor in it just does his job. The way the scenes are set up and established is really good. You get frustrated. You feel for the characters. It's just a really good movie, and it really showed kind of the changing landscape in the 70s. While so many movies were dealing with Vietnam and how that was changing the landscape, this one just went with, like, what happens as feminism really starts to become a more prominent aspect of American culture? And you see the effects that it had on this family in 1979 when things like this weren't understood in the way that they are now. Yeah. And it's a really powerful movie. It's a really good movie. And I highly recommend it. It ended up being much higher in my top on my best picture list than I thought it was going to be, ultimately coming in at number 32, wow. Right in front of Amadeus.
Ooh.
For you.
I don't know about that. I haven't seen Kramer versus Kramer. I haven't seen it yet. So, and you know, quite frankly, movies about divorce, hit a little close to home. Yeah. So they're a little hard for me to watch, but I have to give it a watch at some point.
What's your number four?
My number four is the only one from your top 100 that I watched for the first time that made it onto this list. And that's American Beauty.
Hmm.
I mean, obviously we have an entire podcast, but that movie is spectacular. It's just done so well. Sam Mendes really captures every aspect of this. And yeah, I mean, some of it's unsavory, but it's just done so well.
Yeah. Yeah. Like I was saying with Kramer versus Kramer, how it's kind of the influence of like feminism and how that was affecting the American way and everything like that. The way I look at American Beauty is it's kind of, it's how being the world getting smaller started to affect the nuclear family and how that started to change where things just weren't good enough anymore. It just was not good enough. And I mean, Lester Burnham is living the ultimate American nightmare, even though he's living the American dream. And it's my second favorite. It's 1B with The Deer Hunter as my favorite movie of all time. So I'm very glad that one worked for you, John. I was so prepared for you to watch that and not like it and me have to scream at you in front of a dozen people.
I was honestly prepared to watch it and not like it, which maybe makes it even more impactful that I did like it as much as I did.
Yeah. All right. Number three, this is a series. I have all three of The Human Conditions here because otherwise they would have been 5, 4, and 3. Yeah. I prefer the first part of The Human Condition to the others. And I think the first part might end up in my top 100. I have it as a 4-star movie right now, but I think I bump it to 4.5 after watching parts 2 and 3. It was a tough one because I wanted to really watch all three before making a determination on what I liked more. But the first part is the one that resonates with me the most. And I think about that ending all the time. The frustrations. Is his name Kenji? I think his name is Kenji. The main character of the movies is one of the best written protagonists ever. Akagi, one of the best written protagonists in film history. Just unbelievable. You feel his frustrations. You see that he's trying to do the right thing. You see why he's failing. You see all the problems with Japanese society during World War II. You see all the problems with the way that others were viewing the Japanese in World War II. The way they treat the Chinese, the way they treat the Russians. It's unbelievable. It's 567 minutes, I think. Every single minute of that movie is earned. I have talked openly on here about how I'm not always the biggest fan of Japanese cinema. Akira Kurosawa has made a lot of really good movies. I appreciate them, but I don't necessarily want to go back to them. I would sit down and watch The Human Condition again tomorrow if somebody said you have 9 hours to kill. Like, I just absolutely love these movies. They floored me. And I think part number one will ultimately end up being the one that I give the edge to over the others, but I wanted to talk about it as a whole. Otherwise I was going to talk about part two, then three, then one. And that was going to be five through three on my list. So Human Condition is my number three.
Okay. I still haven't watched them. And the way you've been praising them, I really do need to get around to them sooner than later.
You know what's funny about it? It was one of those things that on Letterboxd had really good reviews, but I was sitting there saying, oh, it's probably just got great reviews because the people on Letterboxd bought it off Criterion and now they want to tell everybody it's really good, even though it's like very meh. No, it is just, it's in a league of its own. It really is. It's incredible filmmaking. Incredible.
Well, my one through three, I've been spending a lot more time with the AFI Top 100 lately, and all of them are found on the AFI Top 100. My number three, though, belongs to David Lean and The Bridge on the River Kwai.
Yeah.
This is a movie that I didn't expect to like as much as I did. Obviously, I've heard of it. I know it has high praise. Man, the movies David Lean made, though, like these epics, he really understands them. He really gets how to make them. And Alec Guinness is incredible in this film. He is so good. And this movie just feels like, again, this different perspective on war and where it takes people and what they can do. And the will of human beings just to persevere and survive.
Yeah, I love The Bridge on the River Kwai. It's one I got to rewatch. I'm such a big David Lean fan. I think he's one of those directors that doesn't get discussed nowadays because he made a style of movie that isn't really relevant to audiences today. But The Bridge on the River Kwai is just such a powerful movie. That ending, when he has to do what he has to do, you're just like, oh my, you feel every ounce of pain and regret and whatever else, whatever other emotion you can list as he is trying to make his decision. It is absolutely incredible. And it really just shows like, you know, humans need things to do. Humans need to have a purpose, even when that purpose seems as flawed as it is in The Bridge on the River Kwai. And that's just a perfect movie. Perfect movie.
Yeah, it is. And there's a reason why it is in my latest iteration, my top 100.
My number two is The Holdovers. Already talked about it a whole bunch. So there it is. That's where it comes in, just above The Human Condition. Although The Human Condition Part 1 might be better than The Holdovers, I'd have to rewatch them both again, now knowing how The Human Condition ends. But The Holdovers is my number two on this list. So what do you got it to?
Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf?
Damn right. You do.
It was phenomenal. We've already talked about it a lot, but it just sometimes Phil suggests a movie and he's like so hyped on it that I'm like, can it really be that good? This one is really that good.
Yeah. This is just, I mean, it's just writing, man. It's just writing. It's one of those movies. It ended and it reminded me why so much of my life has been dedicated to like wanting to be a writer or trying to be a successful writer or doing any of that. Why I would go back and get an MFA at like 27 years old. Why the hell would I waste my time doing that when I'm already working in film? Yeah. It's one of those movies where you say, if I can make people feel the way that movie made me feel, my life will have been a massive success. It's just an insane, insane movie. All right. My number one best first watch of the year goes to The Conversation. Probably one of the most forgotten movies of the 1970s. It came out in 1974, which is an absolutely stacked year. You had The Godfather Part Two, you had Chinatown, you had Lenny. I think the fourth one was The Towering Inferno, which obviously isn't that good, but the 70s are just, it's just loaded every year. And you had Francis Ford Coppola get nominated for Best Picture twice. You know what I mean? So like you had him getting nominated for Best Picture twice. And it was with The Conversation and Godfather Part Two, and Godfather Part Two rightfully won. But The Conversation is an incredible movie. Gene Hackman's performance is 10 out of 10, and it is a dark, depressing, very paranoia-driven movie, and it is just so incredibly well made. It's one of those movies that you shouldn't have been able to do it the way that they were, and they do it so well. And so, I loved The Conversation. I'm kind of frustrated with myself that it took me so long to actually watch it.
I still haven't watched either, so I'm going to get on that one. We mentioned Gene Hackman a couple times in this podcast. I actually watched a Gene Hackman movie yesterday. I watched Runaway Jury, which was also not as good as I remember it being.
Yeah.
But Gene Hackman, man, that guy could act. And it's too bad Welcome to Mooseport made him retire from acting.
It is a shame. It really
is. That movie is infamously the only movie I've ever turned off.
Yeah. That's a really bad movie.
Yeah.
Really bad.
So with my number one, if I had included movies from 2023, it would be Past Lives and everything would be bumped down one. But my number one, I actually rewatched last night. It's A Streetcar Named Desire.
There you go.
That was a movie that caught me off guard. As a movie, like, I had watched On the Waterfront. I was like, Brando's performance in that movie's good, but it didn't like blow me away. Streetcar Named Desire, obviously, like, it's the Tennessee Williams play and everything. I wasn't sure what to expect. I did not expect this very poignant discussion of mental health that film is. And it is, I think, Blanche DuBois is one of the saddest characters in film history.
Yeah.
It's just so, it hurts so much watching her mental degradation throughout this film until she just breaks at the end. It's devastating. It's a devastating film that really feels ahead of its time for coming out in 1951.
Yeah, and I feel like that's how Ilya Kazan was. Ilya Kazan really like did make movies that seemed ahead of their time. On the Waterfront came out a few years later, then East of Eden. I mean, he did even Gentleman's Agreement, which ended up winning Best Picture back in 1947. That was a movie that like you didn't really think would get made at that time. So yeah, Ilya Kazan was really, really a solid director whose name is definitely not one that gets brought up nearly enough or really at all. But yeah, Streetcar Named Desire, I rewatched that this year as well, and I gave that 4 stars. I don't remember what I put as my review. Vivian Leigh, incredible. It's laughable that Brando lost to Bogart for the African Queen. That is 100% true. And yeah, the writing's great. Yeah, it's just a really, really powerful movie and told in a time where like you couldn't get away with showing a lot of stuff. So you had to explain it. And they did such a great job of it.
Everything's just explained in a way where they don't even have to tell you everything that happens for you to understand everything that happens.
Yes.
And the scene where Blanche and Mitch talk and Blanche tells him what happened to her ex-husband is devastating. It just, it wrecks you. It explains everything you've seen in the movie leading up to that point. And all of a sudden there's just a sense of clarity. And it's the point where I feel this movie really elevates itself.
Yeah. No, I agree. I do agree. And yeah, Streetcar Named Desire, one of those ones that's on the AFI top list that you're like, okay, sure. Yeah. It's probably just because it's old. And then you watch it and you say, oh no, I get it. I understand. Yeah. I understand. You have anything else, John, or should we wrap this one up?
No. I mean, if you really want to hear me talk about my top, my top film of this year, just watch in general, we're going to be talking about Past Lives when it gets nominated for Best Picture. It's inevitable.
Yeah, we will be doing that. And become a patron. This is our last podcast of 2023. 2023 was a good year for Cinema Specialist, which was Movie Buff Specialist until about 5 seconds ago. And and 2024 is going to be amazing. Become a patron, patreon.com/thespecialist. $5 Tuesdays. Every Tuesday, if you're a $5 patron, which is $5 a month, we are going to be putting out a podcast about a movie that is hitting a big milestone year release or something along those lines. And that might change as we go on, but that's at least what the month of January is going to be. And we're really excited about it. It's going to be fun discussions. And the first one's going to be Mean Girls. Then we're going to do The Mummy. And then I already said on January 16th, we're going to be doing The Terminator. Those are movies that are 20 years old, 25 years old, and 40 years old. So we're really excited to do that. And you'll get to hear me talk about movies I love and know that I love, or movies that maybe don't like stand the test of time as well as they could have. But at least I won't be just talking about the Marvel Cinematic Universe. So check that out. Become a patron. The first episode drops January 2nd. And thank you all so much for listening. Hope you enjoyed this. Leave in the comments what your favorite episodes or favorite movies and stuff were from this year. Let us know. Yeah. And like the video, subscribe to the channel. There's going to be a lot more movie content coming out in this specialist universe. So thank you all so much. And we will see you next week.